are fascinated with true crime. We can't get enough of it. I am the same way. I'm devoted to the cold case shows on television, and I want to talk a little bit about some cold cases, and especially the Gilgo Beach serial killer. And with us today is one of the most sought-after media resources. He's on our very own News Nation. You'll see him there. He's Joe Giacalone. He's a retired New York police detective sergeant, and he's an adjunct professor and host of the very popular podcast True Crime with Sarge. Welcome to the show, Joe. How are you today?
Good, Karen. I'm doing well. I hope you're doing well, too.
We are doing well here in Chicago. Let's talk a little bit about investigations of crimes. And I just have a first question. Is it something innate? What makes a person a good investigator? Is it something that is innate, or can a person be trained to be observant and to listen and to envelop a crime scene?
It's a little bit of both, but it's more of a learned behavior, right? So the more you do it, the better you'll get at it. You can train yourself on how to be a better observer and looking for certain clues and doing your own reading and researching like a lot of investigators in the past have done. And it's just something that it can be worked on. So, yes.
And, you know, I hear a lot of people say, I would be so good at that. You know, I am just, you know, suspecting of everything, and I'm really good at, you know, noticing things other people don't notice. But actually, there should be some reality show where there's a fake crime scene where people go in and they vie to get, that's probably already out there, Joe. I'm probably behind the times on that one, but... let's start with cold cases. Now, you authored a little manual, the Cold Case Handbook. Why did you write it in the first place?
Well, one of the jobs I had in the New York City Police Department, I was the former commanding officer of the Bronx Cold Case Squad. So it was myself and three detectives that we were in charge of the Bronx cases. But because I was one of three supervisors in the unit, I covered other areas of the city, including Queens, Manhattan, Brooklyn. So just for those that don't know, New York City is made up of five boroughs or five counties. So I was responsible for three counties worth of, old-time homicides and missing persons and sexual assault cases. And to me, it was the ultimate in the investigation part of it, because if it was easy, it would have been closed already. So these cases, you know, had a specific challenge that had to be met. And it gave me, you know, years later, I wrote the book. I was out for almost 10 years before the book actually came out, but it was just something that, to me, I always wanted to get it out there. I thought that maybe we could help from some of the things that we learned from our investigations.
And so when you approach an investigation on a brand new case versus a cold case, say, that's been 10 years unsolved, how do you approach the cold case differently? Can you bullet point for me some of the ways in which you have to treat the investigation differently?
Well, you have to ignore the fact that you actually have a case file and yet you have a part of the investigation or most of the investigation already done for you, which is difficult. So you have to put yourself in the mindset that this case just happened now. And what we used to do is, before we read any of the reports or any other things, because remember, there could be several reasons why this case is cold. One of those could be human error. And if we read the case file first and we read the reports that the investigators before us did, then you end up going down that same path that they did, right? You end up putting on those blinders or get that tunnel vision, and you end up doing and finding exactly what the previous investigators found. So what we used to do is we called it the crime scene walkthrough, where we would take the photos out and just stare at them and look at them and see if there's something in those photos that could help us. Pretend as if this crime just happened now and what we would have to do in regards to this, you know, including crime scene units and the photographs that were taken and any evidence collection lists and so forth, and just try to put that all together in our heads and just see what we can discover from looking and staring at those photos.
And how often, and, you know, just ballpark percentage, when you solve a cold case, you know, was there, you know, there's usually a suspect, you know, in a cold case, sometimes not, but, you know, maybe that there was a leaning toward one particular suspect, but there was just never enough evidence to charge. How often does that person ultimately become the person who gets charged?
Most of the time it does. And I always tell, you know, future investigators or people who are in cold case investigations now that generally, I mean, this is just from my experience, and I don't want to put a number on it, but we'll just say most of the time, the information that you need to solve the case is inside that case folder somewhere. Just somebody missed it, or something wasn't followed up on. And that's why a fresh set of eyes is extremely important in order to try to get these cases kickstarted and moving forward toward a successful conclusion.
And when you see that mistakes might have been made, and that was the reason that the person wasn't charged, you know, 10 years ago, what are those mistakes? What are the common mistakes that are made in an investigation?
Some of them can be as simply as focusing on somebody that wasn't the suspect and wasted too much time and didn't exclude all others. That's one of them. Another error that we saw quite often is not following up on lab work that was submitted, so whether it was DNA or fingerprints or ballistics or what have you. But to me, Karen, the biggest mistake is made by supervisors within the investigative bureau, where they do not have a plan for when a detective gets promoted, retires, or quits, and then sometimes that case gets shuffled off to somebody else, and that continuity gets lost, and the case gets shelved eventually, and that's something that can be addressed and fixed just about everywhere.
Interesting. And then the baton gets dropped, and then someone else has to pick it up, but at that point, it's probably more difficult, right?
They have to start the whole thing all over again, right? And a lot of people don't want to get back into that because they had their own cases. Now you're dumping something else on them. So it's a real problem, but it's something that can be addressed by the executive staff in every police department.
Well, and it seems like I know that in the law, when we are leaving a law firm, there is a transition meeting where it may not even be just a meeting. It may be several meetings where you are handing off your files to somebody else, making sure that the new lawyer understands the nuances of what transpired, what's on the game plan, you know, what the courts did, what the attitudes were, what the clients want, which I would imagine can be done with the police department as well.
Exactly, right? So the deal is, you know, if you want to avoid some of these problems, so if you catch a homicide today, right, or that case happens today, and that detective is on path to be promoted soon, or he or she's retiring or moving on to another unit, that supervisor has to be aware of what's going on and ensure that that detective doesn't catch any more cases that are heavy. And we used to call them heavy cases, so your homicide, your shooting, your non-fatal shootings, your sexual assaults, and those kind of things, we call those heavy cases. Because this detective is not going to be around, and then we're going to have a problem, you know, giving this to somebody else. So the deal is, make sure that the detective that you're assigning this case is going to be around for a while, and I think that can stem some of the problems that we see now with the growing number of cold cases that we see in this country.
We're talking to Joseph Giacalone, who is a retired New York Police Department sergeant. He's also an adjunct professor and the host of True Crime with Sarge, a really nice podcast that I was had the privilege of being a guest on. And if you want to give us a call here, maybe you have a question about cold cases, true crime investigations, 312-981-7200, or you can text me to that same number, 312-981-7200. So, you know, with the advent of cameras everywhere, right, with the advent of DNA technology and all these different mechanisms that we're learning about through all these true crime shows on television, why is it, have clearance rates for crime, serious crimes, gone up or down? And wouldn't you expect to have more clearance, the clearance rates being better with all of these new technologies?
One would think, right? So I believe the last known number for sure was from 2022 in the FBI and the new NIBRS system, the National Incident-Based Reporting System, put out about less than 51% of all homicides are closed through arrest.
Wow.
Which I believe is the lowest level that it has ever been. And if it's not the lowest level, it's pretty darn close. So we have seen a huge problem over the last couple of years with recruitment and retention from the police departments. That's certainly not going to help. But the other thing is that we have a mass exodus of experience and knowledge that have left these police departments also, taking all that information and skills with them and we're left with a much younger detective staff that's trying to do the best they can under the circumstances, but just don't have that individual to count on, that 40-year detective that they can, you know, pick his or her brain and be able to, you know, come up with a solution.
Right. So I have a texter from 773. How true to life are the cold cases on TV? I love that show. So do I. Are there things that you see on these shows that you go, ah, that didn't happen that way?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't watch much of it, but I can tell you this. They're not solved in 45, 30-year cases, not solved in 45 minutes with three commercials.
With commercial breaks, right?
Right, yeah, so that doesn't really happen. But, you know, the issue that comes down to is I think some of those shows do show the dedication that the cold case investigators have. I mean, you have to be, it's a unique type of individual that we look for that, you know, can't be deterred. And, you know, if you're gonna, you get obstacle thrown at you after obstacle. And like I said in the beginning, Karen, if this case was easy or there was enough information in this case and evidence, it would have been closed already, right? So there's something wrong. There's something happened. And it's up to you to figure that out.
We're talking to Joe Giacalone, and I got a text here. I don't think this is something for Joe, but I can answer it. 773, were the Tylenol murders ever solved? And that was one of the hottest, coldest case in Chicago, and yep. It's never been solved. There was a man who was suspect. He just died, I think, last year, as a matter of fact, but he was never charged. The crime right now is still a cold case, although they say that there are still investigations that are going on. But that was a uniquely Chicago case and one that we followed here. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation and talk about the Gilgo Beach murders here on WGN. Oh, I still got a minute. Anyway, let me just ask you this, Joe. Where can people listen to your podcast?
Okay, it's on YouTube at True Crime with the Sarge. You can just type that in there. You'll find it. And you can probably type your name in too, Karen, because I had you on the show a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about John Wayne Gacy and a couple other things. But, yeah, I mean, I'm pretty easy to find on the internet. And, you know, I try to, we do quizzes on the channel and everything else that goes along with it.
It's a very intelligent show. I mean, you know, you are an adjunct professor, so you taught police officers on how to do this. You speak really well. You do a lot of media appearances. So I would highly recommend, if you are looking for a podcast, that you're going to learn about police investigations and how police officers think. This is the show to watch. It's called True Crime with the Sarge. And now we're going to take a break on WGN. Welcome back. That was what really probably my favorite show of all time when it comes to detectives, the Rockford Files. And listen, ladies and gentlemen, it's not named Rockford Files because we have a town in Illinois named Rockford. That was the name of the detective, just so I'm filling you in. We have a lot of nice people here leaving comments. First of all, we're here with Joe Giacalone. He is a retired New York Police Department sergeant and podcaster, adjunct professor, and he's a media commentator. You'll see him on News Nation here. Thank you. I love your show. And you sound like the late Ray Liotta. Maybe that's just because we think that everyone with the New York accent sounds like Ray Liotta.
Yeah, everyone tells me I have an accent, but I don't hear it.
Yeah, you do. You kind of do. But we're not going to hold that against you because we find that kind of charming. There was a question from that my producer got. How far back can a cold case go? And one of the things that I'm going to use to discuss this, and you may not know anything about it, but I'm always obsessed with this case, the Valerie Percy case, and some of my younger listeners will probably not remember this at all, but she was the daughter of the candidate for U.S. Senator Charles Percy, and it was back in 1966 in the town of Kenilworth, which is probably one of the most affluent, if not the most affluent, cities in Chicago area. And she was found brutally murdered in her mansion, and she had a twin sister, and no one could ever figure out what was going on. And here's my question with this, Joe. I know that there are people who are investigators, retired, who would love to delve into this and try to get to the bottom of it. But the police, even now, after all these decades, are still saying it's an open investigation. Why do police departments say that when they probably really aren't investigating it?
Yeah, this is a big problem. And it's something that I did include in the new book. And that is that, you know, it has to come to a certain point where all leads are exhausted, all information is exhausted, And then we need to open it up to a different set of individuals out there, whether they're retired cops or we've seen these cold case symposiums that are opening up in different states. There's something out there that can be done better, and we need to figure out what that is. Because at this point, after the case has been open for, let's say now, 50-something years, I mean, what harm can you do by opening it up to other outside individuals that you can just, you know, maybe you can find something?
Yeah, I mean, that's how I feel. Like, I feel like more eyes are better at that point. It's not like you're going to taint an investigation that's just hot and going on. And, you know, again, it makes you feel like, what are they hiding, right? I mean, what are you protecting somebody even after all these years? And people come up with all these conspiracy theories just because of these kinds of decisions. And I don't think that's good for anyone, you know, because they're probably false, but it makes people think, right?
Well, yeah. And when the police department, you know, fails to come out and discuss exactly what's going on, that leaves that vacuum open for that, you know, the speculation and stuff like that. I mean, yes, could ego get in the way? Yeah, for some people it could. But the issue that comes down to is we almost had a huge win coming out of Connecticut. There was a case that they went back and forth and made it all the way up to the Connecticut Supreme Court to do just this, open up the case after a certain point to give it to other individuals. And unfortunately, it was defeated at that point. But I think that we'll see other states' cases and family members take these things far and then do this. I mean, listen, there's some hope with the federal statute that came, the federal law that came out, the Homicide Victims' Rights Act that came out in the end of, you know, 2022, as well as Help Find the Missing Act. Those two federal laws are big, and they need to expand that federal law to the states, too. I think that would help dramatically. And one of those things was that after a certain time period, or going back to a certain year, I believe the January 1st, 1970 is the, you know, is the point that the cases can go back to. And it has to be within 3 years. If nothing's been done on the case, they can open, you know, reexamine it and do this as per request from a family member. So I think there's something at play. I think things will change. It's like everything else, Karen. You know, as the younger generations take over and are more progressive in certain things, this will change.
I agree. And, you know, there have been crimes that have been solved via podcast or via public outcry and community, involvement. And I'm sure they get in the way sometimes of active investigations when you've got people taking different positions that maybe aren't based in fact. But like you said, after so many years, what what harm can it do possibly?
Well,
go ahead.
Just to add another point to that, you know, as well as you go, they go through a process, right? So if we're going to open up a case file with crime scene photos and stuff like that, we have to ensure that these things aren't leaked out onto the internet and those kind of things. So you see things like non-disclosure agreements being signed at the risk of getting sued if you, you know, release information about the case. And then, you know, some maybe background checks from the department. So it's not going to be just one of those things where they're just going to invite everybody in. I think they'll do it, but it'll be a controlled environment and that kind of thing.
One of the things you see in some of these cold case shows are the families who just don't give up. They, you know, I was listening to one coming back from Wisconsin yesterday, hearing, you know, the mother who just wouldn't give up and no one was looking and they closed the case and she just kept persevering. How much does that help when the families just won't give up and they continue to put pressure on the police?
It's a great thing. I think that pressure is important. I also think the involvement from the family is extremely important because, like the old saying, right, the squeaky wheel gets the grease kind of thing.
Yep.
We used to love when we get a call from family members to say, hey, listen, this is the case, because most of the time we never heard about the case because we were buried under so many that sometimes that you get one and say, all right, let's see what this is all about, right? So it's a new adventure, so to speak, and there's something that can do that. And the idea of having a family member is extremely important because you get to know your victim. You get there might be some photographs. There might be DNA still left at home, right, whether from, you know, clothes or hairbrushes or toothbrushes. So there, it opens up a lot for you. So I encourage family members to, you know, get involved in the process, stay with the process. But I've also seen some things where, you know, like the old saying goes, you get more bees with honey than you do with vinegar or something like that. And, you know, attacking the police and telling them that they're no good and all those other things is not going to help your cause for sure.
Right. It's a fine balance, being respectful but persistent. And some of these people, you know, that's their only way of closure, as if, you know, you can have any closure at all when you have a loved one who's been murdered. It's just hard to even imagine. We have to take a break again. But when we come back, I want to quickly go to the Gilgo Beach Long Island serial killer murders. You have been very near that whole process, probably over the years that these women were being murdered, and now that the suspect is apprehended, I want to kind of get your view on it. You've done a lot of commentary on News Nation and CNN, and I've seen you do some really interesting analysis of this. So when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Joe Giacalone on WGN. Welcome back. We're talking about cold cases and police investigation with our special guest, Joe Giacalone. Thanks for holding. Joe, let's talk about the Gilgo Beach or Long Island serial killer murders. Can you briefly just tell our listeners who may not have heard about these murders when they happened and what is going on now with the investigation?
Sure. The short version is that around May of 2010, there was a woman named Shannon Gilbert who disappeared from a town called Oak Beach on Long Island. And she had left a 20-something minute 911 phone call about her whereabouts. And that's what kicked off the entire investigation. So the police had gotten there and did their investigation. And then over the next couple of months, while they were looking for Shannon, a cadaver dog stumbled upon the remains of an individual. And then it just seemed to snowball from there. The first four girls that they found, they called, referred to as the Gilgo Four, were wrapped in some sort of burlap, left out in this bramble or brush. It was not visible from the street, but it was something that it's almost like a barrier island that this was located on. And it was, you know, home to surfers and beachgoers and those kind of things. And, you know, after they were done searching, they found the remains of 10 women there. And some of the remains were dismembered, and they found it in other locations from Long Island. So it started tying other cases together that happened in Nassau County and Suffolk County. And it just seemed to grow by the day. And it was something that really took over the news cycle for a long period of time.
And, you know, and then there were charges brought against a Manhattan architect named Rex Howerman. He was charged in July of last year with the death of three, and then additional charges were recently added, and they're talking about perhaps being additional victims tied to him. Now, first of all, let's talk about what you have seen the evidence is against him, and do you think it's strong at this point?
Right, so they arrested Rex Howerman. I can't believe it's been over a year already.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's gone by quickly. And he's been now charged in six homicides. And they've done this via a secret grand jury and superseding indictments, meaning that all of these cases are going to be tried at once right now. And the latest two women that they attached to him, Sandra Castilla and Jessica Taylor, are really interesting because Sandra Castilla was not even thought of initially by investigators as part of this case. They thought it was involving of another killer. This guy, John Bitroff, allegedly was responsible for her, according to the district attorney back then. So this case took on a new and different meaning because her case also dated this back to 1993. So the interesting part is that they have recovered DNA, which the police have told us and the district attorney have told us has been transferred DNA, and that transferred DNA has come from the suspect himself, the suspect's wife, and the suspect's daughter. So hair follicles and the like. And the latest search of the residence that they did in combined, I think they said they recovered over 400 digital devices and all kinds of stuff. I mean, the forensics is adding up, the digital forensics is adding up, and it's becoming probably will be the largest case in New York State history.
And I don't know this as well as you do, but aren't there other serial killers who were working in that very same area in addition to Rex Howerman?
The ironic part of it is in 1993 now, Long Island had four active serial killers working during that year. So you had John Bitroff, who was considered based on the definition. He was convicted of killing two women. But you have now Rex Sherman gets added to the mix. You had this guy, Robert Shulman, who's been convicted, and Joel Rifkin, who's been convicted of serial killings.
What is it about the water?
I don't know. You know, Long Island is a very big place, even though it's an island. I don't know how many millions of people are living on there now. But it's something that needs to be studied to find out what exactly transpired there, for sure.
So this Rex Howerman, as we watched, there was an initial search of his house, and I remember that, and the wife and the child left, and then there was a second. Investigation of the house where they were taking out huge boxes. Why would there have been a second one? I mean, wouldn't you think, like, with the magnitude of these crimes, that they would have done everything, including taking up the floorboards and everything else, to get whatever evidence might be there over really what amounts to decades?
Well, it's a great question, but the answer to that is simply they didn't have that information the first time around. So remember, in order to get the second search warrant, they had to reestablish probable cause. You just can't go back a year later and say, hey, we want to go back and search, right? You know as well as I do that doesn't work. So they developed something from that information, whether it's from the digital evidence that they found or what have you, that led them to pick. They went in this time, they removed paneling and ceiling tiles and all kinds of stuff, ropes. You name it, that they found this time around that they didn't really understand or know about at the time of the first one back in last July.
You talked about transfer DNA, and can you just tell our listeners a little bit about that? And we're not suggesting that because the wife and the child's DNA was on the victims or at the crime scene that they had anything to do with it, right?
Well, we'll start with the first question first. The theory of transfer of evidence between two objects comes from Locard's exchange principle, which was based on Edmond Locard, who was a criminologist from France going back in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And his theory of transfer is when two objects come together, one person leaves something behind and one other person takes something with them. And I always tell my students, it's like if you have a cat, right, the day you're going out and you're wearing your new black pants or jeans, that's the time the cat's going to rub up against you and leave all the fur on it, right? So that's an example of Edmund's Locard exchange principle. So the district attorney has been very firm in the respect that the family has not involved in any of these cases. He even included it in the last superseding indictment that the family was out of town when these cases happened. According to the district attorney, that when the families were out of town, this is when these incidents have happened, right? So we don't have exact times and dates where these women were last seen or when they went missing, and that kind of puts things in other perspectives. But right now we're going to go with what the district attorney is telling us.
And does Rex Harriman fit the profile from what you can understand? And what is the profile and how does he kind of dovetail into that?
Well, I'm not really the profile guy per se, but you know what? This is like one of those situations where, you know, everyone basically saying, you know, he might have been odd, but they didn't suspect anything. And I always tell my students, right, remember your mom or your grandmother tells you, be careful of the quiet ones, right? They generally don't want to draw attention to themselves, and that's generally, you know, how it goes. But, if you remember, there were some issues with the police department. There was some corruption with the chief of police and the district attorney. Both went to prison, and the FBI was removed from the entire county over what we can probably surmise or speculate that it was regarding what was going on between the chief of police and the district attorney, that they didn't want the feds involved. There's also, you know, that big issue, right? So the FBI was locked out of that from the very beginning. And then we had the new chief come in and put this task force together. Boy, within a year or so, they had this arrest made. So it just goes to show you, when you put the right people in the right places and that fresh set of eyes, you can see a lot of good things can happen.
And, you know, talking about profile, I mean, I am not a profile either by any means, but, you know, having represented John Wayne Gacy, I see so many parallels between them. I mean, Gacy also had a family. He had a house. He was a successful construction worker. Howerman was a architect. Some of these women were sex workers. Gacy had some sex workers, not all. But basically, you know, this guy lived a pretty successful life, pretty, out there life. life, no issues, and yet at night he was going out and doing this, if in fact he is the guilty one. So I see a lot of parallels between the two of them. Before we wrap up, you know, my some of the other hosts on these shows have been following what we see is this trend in Chicago. We see, like, I want to say there's about 20 young men. They're usually white. They're usually somewhere in their early 20s. They're highly educated, usually. They're coming out of a venue, whether it's a bar or a party or a concert. They go missing for a period of time, and then they're found in the Chicago waterways. And it just keeps happening. We had, like, three in 1 week a while ago. We've had some of the family members on our show talking about it. The police are not saying anything about there being a serial killer. But I know you don't know these facts, but at what point do you say, as a police officer, let's look at these, you know, being connected?
Well, I could tell you something from experience. Investigators will tell you we don't believe in coincidences, and there's something that really needs to be looked at. And actually, I was interviewed for that story a way back. I'm in one of your local papers or stationed somewhere on this case, because there's another one that's happening down in Texas, I believe, too. Lady Lake.
Yes.
There's another situation.
Same thing.
Where you're dealing with.
Yes.
Yeah, you're dealing with this kind of stuff. So let's put it this way. It's important that investigators take a hard look at what they have, what's going on in these guys' lives, what's doing, because there, you know, there are situations that could be at play that it could involve criminality. And the only way to be able to do that is if there's proper investigations done, and if you handle every death as if it's suspicious until proven otherwise.
That sounds like a good plan. Joe, thank you so much for joining us. Joe Giacalone, you're going to come back and talk about other crimes and other issues, I'm quite sure. But in the meantime, please tune in to his podcast, which is really, really good. It's True Crime with the Sarge, where you can find any podcast. You'll find it. Joe Giacalone, that's Giacalone, True Crime with the Sarge. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a good rest of your Sunday.
You too, Karen. Nice talking to you.
All right, take care. So when we come back, we're going to be talking a little bit about stalking. And I don't know if you watched this Netflix phenomenon called Baby Reindeer. It's been watched by somewhat like 85 million viewers. And as I said in my opening earlier in my show, it's not the easiest thing to watch. And if you're a person who gets triggered by sexual content and violence, you may not be the person to watch this series. But I do believe it's well done. I do believe it has some really good themes. And one of the themes that is of interest to me is stalking. And we're going to have a guest who is very, very familiar with the psychology of stalking. And I'm going to ask him all those kind of questions. If you have a question, 312 312-